it's not really about overcoming the fear. It's about having the fear at all. So most people would say courage is overcoming fear. But I think if you have the fear at all, you can't really be authentic because you'll just be held back. It'll require too much energy to resist that fear. You instead need to be just totally fearless.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This podcast is a venue for me to follow my curiosity through conversations with leading thinkers and builders. My guest today is Nick. Nick is a writer and podcaster. We talk about presence, skepticism, religion, fearless authenticity, balancing seriousness and fun, relationships, and podcasting. Please enjoy.
I also grew up in the church. And what I found as life has gone on, and I wouldn't say I was averse to the message of the, like, some of the underlying tenets or values of the church. But I've definitely come full circle on some things. And I was wondering if you have had a similar experience where there were things growing up that troubled you, or you felt guilty about, or you dealt with authority maybe in a negative way, and you've come full circle on those things and come to appreciate them. I know one, for example, in your writing, you said you now read the Bible through a different lens than you used to, but you still derive value out of it. So just wondering if there's things you've now come to recognize as valuable within, you know, Christianity or religion in general.
Absolutely. One thing before I answer your question is that there does seem to be this stream of Christian exiles that exist in Twitter, which isn't necessarily to say that they're not Christian anymore, but they definitely grew up Christian, and then they reacted to that or responded to that in some sort of aggressive way where they pivoted. And there's this huge community of it, but it's a little bit strange because it's like something we're not entirely focused on. We don't talk about it that much, but it's so common to hear that story that it's kind of like one of those things that is just left unsaid, but definitely defines a lot of what brings people together, which is very strange because it seems to be like this rationalistic approach. But I think one of the things that combines a lot of people in our community is just the fact that they think a lot about how to live and how to seek meaning and what all of this means for people. And in defining that, we have, or trying in pursuing that, we have developed community around that way of thinking. So I just think that's cool that, like, a lot of people share that. To answer your question about essentially how I think about what I was learning and maybe what I was wrong about back then and how I could, you know, reflect in perhaps a more mature way now, is that when I was child, I had this sense that I had to figure out how everything worked. Like, I wanted to understand God. I really did. And I would see God in trying to kind of reason through what the Bible said and what I was taught. And I would ask, you know, even when I was fairly small, I would ask all these questions about, like, well, if God created the environment for Adam and Eve, and then he puts this environment, like, puts them in an environment where they can sin, and then he kind of creates the storyline, how are they in any way responsible for their actions, especially if he's like omniscient? So I would be like that annoying student that would be asking you all of these questions. And most of the time, they didn't really have a very satisfying answer, and they would say something like, God is mysterious, which, as a kid, I'm like, God is, like, okay, frankly, you don't know what you're talking about, so you can't even give me an answer, so I'm just going to, like, forget that. But now that I'm older, I realize, like, that's the answer. Like, the answer is that, like, it's not only that God is mysterious, but life is mysterious. Like, I always thought of divine and divinity as, like, this power that comes down from heaven and is, like, supernatural and is in no way really like natural or human. It's this other thing. And what I realized is that divinity is fairly synonymous with mystery. And this gets into a little bit of, like, kind of a non-Christian perspective. There are a lot of other religions that see it this way, but it's really the seeking certainty, which is really that like human hubris and ego that is really tying us down. But when we develop a comfort with uncertainty, then we can start to observe I would say the true nature of the world. And then you can start getting into concepts of like the kingdom of God and the power of God. And it sounds to me a little bit like I'm preaching, but it's not like there was, you know, a guy that was born of a virgin and you have to praise him because you can sense this, you know, special thing about the world. It's rather just that, like, once you open yourself up to the nature of the world and the way that mystery isn't something that you need to get rid of, but it's something to be in awe of, then you can start to interact with something of the divine that exists for us all in every moment.
I tweeted a while back that I think religion from the point of view of the, I'll call it the participant or the consumer is a negative connotation on it. But the person receiving it, the primary objective is to mitigate uncertainty about the world around you. You want to believe in something else that provides answers about, you know, those three big questions: where do we come from, why are we here, and where are we headed? And it is, I think, our root fear is something to do with this idea of uncertainty and ambiguity and, you know, what comes after. So it's interesting. It sounds like you came around to being comfortable with uncertainty, and that opened up a new lens for you in terms of observing the world that wasn't previously possible. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah. And it's a little bit hard to describe because I'm not talking about some type of knowledge. I'm not talking about something that you can communicate to someone. It's really just like a way of seeing. And you can kind of describe how to get there. But when you do get there, it doesn't feel like you really followed anybody's advice. You kind of just like accidentally find yourself with a different perspective. So it's definitely not prescriptive. It's just something that's, for me, personal.
This sounds a lot like I had somebody early on in the podcast who claimed to be enlightened, a claim I can't confirm or deny, given I'm not that. But it sounds very similar in the sense that he spoke a lot about. And when I read folks like Jed McKenna or Krishnamurti or whoever, this concept of pointing at the thing, hinting at it, not following prescriptions, not mistaking the finger for the moon. It feels like there's a lot of similarities between the realization that you had in that kind of line of thinking. Does that resonate with you? And were there similar sources of information that kind of like sparked this realization for you? Even though you said it's ultimately a personal pursuit, were there authors you were reading or gurus you were listening to or events in your life that led to kind of this this transformation, this flip of a switch?
All right. So I'm going to answer this by first saying that like my concept of the divine was not my primary revelation. It was like one of the revelations that I used, and then I eventually ended up at like this like remarkable state of presence. What I did in order to get there, or in order to like, you know, accidentally get there, because I wasn't trying really to do anything, I was just very curious and looking, you know, at the world. But I was practicing skepticism. I realized in retrospect, I didn't actually realize at the time, but I realized in retrospect, I was practicing skepticism. And I don't mean that in like the English Wiktionary definition. I mean it in like the Buddhist and the Greek definition of like this practice of not trying to constantly find answers for everything, but instead, you know, resting in mystery and resting in uncertainty and becoming more aware of what you do know and more aware of what you don't know. And this begins to dissolve your beliefs about yourself and the world. And then like I came, for me, the like the revelation that was the real trigger revelation was the one about time, which people always want to talk to me about, but I always have a really hard time talking about, because it was definitely, again, one of these things that's more experiential and not really conceptual. So you can try to talk about it, but I think the best you can ever really do is try to walk somebody toward that experience. But if you just tell them, you know, you, it's kind of like you could show them the physics calculations and they could see them and be like, okay, maybe you're right. But that doesn't actually change their experience of the world. So it's not even necessarily that useful. But that was the trigger for me. And after that point, it was just kind of like an amazing gratitude and appreciation for life, and like a constant recognition of like momentum worry. That was just kind of like the, I would say my experiences of those things were as significant as most people's experiences of like their own thoughts would be. So like I was experiencing the like immediacy of the moment in the same way that somebody might experience like their selfhood, like that it was that fundamental for me during that period. And, you know, it's kind of strange for me to talk about because I'm not experiencing it right now, but during, you know, that time, like now all I have is the memory, right? Which is kind of unreal. So I try to remember what the experience was like, but our memories of things and our names for things are, you know, they're like fragile, like you were talking about earlier, or weak, not entirely accurate. And so I'm more dependent on my writing back then than I really depend on my memory of it.
You have a thread on your realizations related to time, but I think it's important context to include here. So if you don't mind diving a little bit deeper on what specifically was your realization about this conception of time that unlocked this new perspective on the world or way of experiencing the world.
Sure. So while I was practicing skepticism, what I would do is I would ask myself a question of something that I believed in pretty strongly, like the fact that order exists, or the fact that chaos exists, or, you know, or what is a relationship? Because I believe relationships are very important. And if I believe relationships are important, then I must believe they are real. So let's look at this. And I would just think a lot. At the time, I was doing physical labor, and so my mind was pretty much free, you know, all day to think about whatever I wanted. And I would just think about, like, kind of answering this question. And I would take the certainty that I had. So, like, I would, you know, the like Webster's dictionary definition. And, you know, you take that answer, and you kind of sit with it, and you take it apart and recognize how it's not correct, like how it's hinting at something, but it's also not correct. And you do this over and over and over and over again until the concept itself is kind of broken down into, instead of this concrete thing, it's more of like this like fabric or something that's very nebulous. And once you have this thing that's very nebulous, you're no longer very strongly attached to it, because you kind of just recognize it as this improvisational tension between other things that are kind of that same material. And so as you walk down like your schema of reality, you start like kind of just breaking down all of these really, really concrete concepts you have. And at this point, this is mostly conceptual. But as you do this a lot, you know, over months, then you really start to see things in a different way. You really start to see your relationships and your actions and, you know, things like money and things that are important in the world, just in a way that's not so defensive. And so I was walking down that path, And I happened to be thinking about time because I was like, what the hell? Like, what is this time? Like 1 second per second? Like that kind of sounds fake. But like, what is this thing? And this was, I think this was immediately after I was thinking about chaos and entropy, which are difficult to really wrap your head around. Or for me anyway, it was very challenging to define those things in any concrete way. And everybody seemed to disagree about what they were. So that was interesting. But anyway, so after chaos and entropy, I was thinking about time a lot. And I think just from the foundation of having broken down or kind of released all of these other concepts, I was really able to kind of rest like my mind on time for a long, ironically, a long period of time. And I just got to the point where I actually remember the moment I was at my hairdresser and I was talking about this with my hairdresser. She must have thought I was insane. And I'm like working, I'm trying to like work through it because after you realize, like, I really don't know what time is, this is not a coherent concept. What you start to do is just look at your experience of it. So, so in the same way that you might experience heat, you might try to break down all the components of your experience of it. And so that's kind of what I started doing, was just looking directly at my experience of time and putting a lot of focus on what is my experience of time. And like, I guess I just had like a glimpse of the impermanence of reality, sort of. I don't like, it's hard to talk about. And then like, I recognized that the real thing that told me that time was real was like this anticipation I had and this anxiety I had and these certain ideas about how the world works, but that made up like the entirety of the concept. That it was really just the anxiety, the anticipation, the experience of memory, and these ideas that I have right now, right? And so I guess when I was able to look at those directly, that unraveled something for me. And then I was able to kind of put those things aside and just take the moment for what it was. Yeah, it was very nice. It was just extremely pleasant because when you take away like the anticipation or the anxiousness, and it certainly exists because you function, right? Like you're a functional person. You don't like forget that you need to step on the gas pedal. But you can kind of just trust that you're going to do these things. You don't have to like have anxiety. Then like, there's like this really, really low level of anxiety that pursues all action when you're really tied up in your mind about like what the future is going to be like and what you have to do. And when you let go of that and you kind of just let yourself do, you know, your own job essentially, and you can just kind of like take the moment as beautiful and that's it. And like, so it's very uncomplicated.
I have this blog post on my old blog that was kind of the culmination of a similar realization, although I have a lingering question, but I want to read it to you and then I want to come back to the question. So the blog post, it's really short. I titled it The Source, and it goes, the root of all anxiety and fear is a misunderstanding of time. The past and future do not exist in the present, but we believe and act as if they do. We focus on the past, regretting or feeling nostalgic, or on the future, fearing or fantasizing. We judge the present by the past and set expectations for the future. We distort reality and ruin the moment, all thanks to our past conditioning and slavery to thought. And yet, mm-hmm. realizing yep. this isn't enough to free us. The game has more levels before the shackles come off. So I don't know if this is, you know, one for one, the realization you had, but there was something about the conception of time that I wrestled with as well. And I don't know if it was the language we were using to describe it, and of course how language always falls short of the actual thing itself. It's right. kind of yeah. like this middleware between us and the actual experience or thing. I yeah. wasn't sure if it was that or like actually time, if that makes sense. But this realization, if you can call it that, didn't have the same effect or quality that yours did, in that like I still live 80% of my life in the past or the future, still have anxiety and anticipation and expectations. what, and obviously you aren't in my head, so you can't compare the experiences directly, but what is that extra layer or that next set of questions that gets you to truly kind of embody that realization? What am I missing here?
First of all, I would just want to say, like, out of humility, like, I'm not, you know, I'm
of course
also 80%, like, right now 80% anxious or whatever, and I am nowhere near like my happiest or my best. And you know, in the moment it almost feels like an accident. Like, the only thing I could say really is that, like, at the time I'd been meditating regularly, and that I had been meditating. I went from meditating like 20 minutes a day to meditating like, I got to a point where I was meditating essentially all day. And, you know, obviously I wasn't like perfect at it. Like, I would get distracted, but it was somewhat easy for me to notice that I was getting distracted. Or sometimes I would kind of like let go of it so that, you know, I could instrumentalize myself. And that, I think, gets back to like what you were saying, your quotes, that this, like, thinking about time and thinking about the past, thinking about the future, is the constant instrumentalization of life, that we are using this moment for something else. Mm-hmm. And in instrumentalizing the moment, we lose that immediacy, right? Like, we lose the truth of it. And when you're constantly in that marketplace, you know, it almost seems like there's no other possibility. So kind of getting back to what I was saying earlier, at the time I happened to be regularly meditating. Like, you know, I would just be like, okay, I'm going to count my breaths. And then I would count my breaths like 3,000 breaths, you know, and that was just like normal. And I would be talking to other people, I would be doing other things, and then I would just have the number in my head that I was just paying attention to my breath the entire time. Just things like that, which I don't even think it's really an achievement. If anything, it just says that, like, I was doing physical labor and allowed me to do that. But that definitely opened up a level of perhaps concentration that allowed me to look at these things very clearly. And because I was able to look at them very clearly, I was able to start paying attention to all of my sensations without identifying with them, and like stop thinking that like my sight is up here in my head and my, you know, the feeling of my toes are down there, but instead all sensation is just like a you know, locationless existence within consciousness, and consciousness itself is kind of like this tautological thing that, like, the feeling of your hand is the feeling of your hand. And the concept of your hand is simply the concept of your hand, and it is not your hand, things like that. And so I was able to kind of like blow that out. And that was like the first step for me into starting this practice of really dissolving my beliefs. Like, that was all necessary for me anyway. I'm sure everybody experiences this a different way, but that was for me like just the prerequisite.
Fascinating. So you've said a few times now that you no longer are in this state of being. Is it permanently, or you're since you fell out of that state, you haven't revisited it, I guess, permanently or even for a limited period of time?
I've noticed that I have some things that I can do with my mind that I would not have been able to do before then. You know, so like I can access like this immediacy or this kind of oneness, but it's not the same. It's just a change of perspective, and I wouldn't even say it's very special. But you know, you can just look, right? Just in the moment, you can just look and see. And so I can do that now, but it does take like practice. Like, it takes like constant practice and commitment to get to a place where you can like maintain that. And I'm not there right now. You know, I'm often distracted. and distracted in the way that, like, just, you know, regular people would be distracted, easily forgetful. And, you know, I definitely don't admire, you know, the place I'm at right now. But of course, you know, that all gets back to instrumentalization, judging oneself, you know, seeing oneself as an object and all of that. So I would say right now I'm just in a period of kind of accepting where I'm at and doing what I want to do in order to move forward. And it is obvious to me, and like my follow-up question here would be like, so why? Like, why aren't you, you know, knees on the ground dedicating your whole life to this?
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. So go ahead.
And it's a great question that I say to myself. But no, it's an important question. And it's kind of like, this is where the whole luck thing gets into it, that we feel agentic all the time, but we're also caught, like, we just so easily get caught up and, like, you know, I don't know if I would call it laziness or whatever. I don't know. But it can just be really challenging to, in any moment, like, get back, like, to drop everything and to, you know, get back to a mindset that I was, you know, fortunate to have because I had, you know, I guess you could say this history that led up to that point. And whereas my history now is different. So, you know, there's no really good answer. It's kind of like, why didn't you write that book yet? It's like, well, I'm working on it. You know? It's really just that.
Why isn't that state something that was a permanent, and I guess I would have to ask you to guess at it or hypothesize why, or else you would be able to revisit it consistently if you wanted to. But why wasn't it something that was permanent? Why wasn't it a fixed realization, like a turning point, rather than something you had to constantly remind yourself of or practice?
My theory of this is that it's because what a lot of people would call like the ego or this instrumentalization or whatever, it serves a purpose, and it also is sort of the default. So the question is like, why didn't this change in perspective? Why didn't that change your default perspective? And so it's kind of like, you know, if Chrome is your default browser and you open up, you know, Edge or Firefox, why didn't that become your default browser? And it was just, I guess there's another step that I don't really know. You know, I guess you would just have to be, again, fortunate enough to go there and change your default browser. But yeah, so I was, you know, using Firefox for a while. And then, you know, I guess my computer shut down, the power went off, and I opened it back up and Chrome was there. So that, I guess that's my answer, that, you know, I don't know how to do any of this, you know what I mean? Like, I can't tell anybody. It's just kind of, I could just tell you the circumstances. It's like Bill Gates, right? Like, how did Bill Gates become Bill Gates? Well, he had all of these circumstances and he ended up there. And yes, there was hard work. And yes, he, you know, grew up in the right place at the right time. And, you know, and he had all these successes and all these challenges that he overcame. But it's like, is that why? It's complicated. You know, you can't point to any one thing. You can't reproduce, you know, you can't really reproduce anybody's success. So not to phrase myself as a success, that would be crazy to me. But it's definitely like there is this, you know, it's very complicated. And you have to, I think ultimately, you have to pursue what is right for you in any given moment. And that's true for me then. That's true for me now, and that's true for everybody all the time, that what's right for you is not always just going to be like pursuing enlightenment. Like, what's right for you might change. You know, everything is impermanent.
You had alluded to this, but what are you shelving the pursuit of enlightenment in favor of? What are you pursuing instead now?
That's I like that question. Get at that, I think we have to look at a little bit of my history here, which is that, so I was in this state of presence, and frankly, it had started wavering a little bit in intensity. Like, it was still there, but the intensity had it wasn't quite as vivid as initially, and I recognized that. And then, so I was in a relationship with a girl, and she got in a really, really bad car accident. And to put this into perspective, like, she long distance relationship, and she had been, you know, we were meeting up for vacation that weekend, and she had been driving to get her hair done for our vacation, like 2 days out, and we're both super excited. And the car crash was so traumatic that, like, her whole personality changed. And we would, you know, we like continued to talk, but it was like, it was like I wasn't talking to her. I was, you know, she had just been so traumatized that in that moment, the relationship had just ended. And when I received that text message that she had been in a really bad car accident, and that, like, and just like her kind of terror and suffering and all of this stuff, I just completely lost it. And, you know, in a way that probably I never would have, except that I was in this really, really unguarded state at the time. But I reacted in a way that was, you know, I think that if you think of a normal person in this situation, you would think that they would be heartbroken and really sad, maybe go home, you know, talk to some friends. But no, I was like absolutely distraught, like inconsolably distraught. And she was okay. That's the thing, is that, like, she wasn't really hurt. She just got kind of bruised. But it was really the terror of the thing that really affected her. And that, for me, it kind of, like, all of my defense mechanisms got thrown up, because it affected me in a way that I think that just my psyche recognized was not appropriate or like not acceptable. And so in that moment, I went from, like, you know, pretty present to just like full on neurosis, anxiety, the most I'd ever experienced in my life. And I was a mess. And then after that point, it was kind of like I wasn't responding to the immediacy of anything anymore. It was kind of just like coping, you know? So I just started coping. And a lot of my life since then has kind of, you know, been more of that flavor. And, you know, so I got into another relationship and, you know, was very, very hopeful, bright-eyed, you know, really, really trying. We both tried very hard, but the whole time it was still kind of like that instrumentalization, right? Like coping, trying to take care of my own issues and trying to be a good partner and trying, always trying for something. And I still am, I guess I'm like that, like, you know, trying for emotions and trying to have a good podcast and all of that, where in when you're experiencing immediacy, you're not really trying for anything. You're just observing yourself acting appropriately, which is very, very different. So I don't really have a very satisfying answer.
I feel like I've harped on this topic enough. So I'll make a bit of a 180 or a turn here. One of the reasons I wanted to talk with you is because you seem to do from your Twitter profile and from your podcast, you seem to do a good job of straddling this kind of deeply philosophical, analytical, wanting to get to the truth kind of perspective, as well as a very unserious, like, humorous approach to life. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Visa Khan Verasamy's meme of, like, sitting in between these two kind of poles and saying, oh, like, laughing my ass off, like, that's yeah. just the way life is, and you're constantly pulled between these two, comes to mind. But there's something about the way you do it that seems more, I don't know what the right word is, like, elegant or authentic or raw. And I was just wondering if you could speak to, I guess, first, whether that's a fair, like, understanding of how you grapple with or straddle those two poles.
Yeah.
And what kind of challenges or dissonance you might feel day to day, shifting between these modes of like seriousness and unseriousness.
All right. I think if I do have any talent, like for Twitter or for storytelling, for instance, it's that I do have a ability to be somewhat authentic, and I think the thing that's necessary for that is to be a bit fearless. I don't even know if you could call it courage, but I think that if you are really fearful, like, it's not really about overcoming the fear, it's about having the fear at all. So most people would say courage is overcoming fear, but I think if you have the fear at all, you can't really be authentic, because you'll just be held back. It'll require too much energy to like resist that fear. You instead need to be just totally fearless. And I think I have a little bit of that. Like, if there's anything special about me, it's that I'm not really scared about, like, I do care what people think of me, but I'm not really scared that I'm going to come to harm for being authentic, which allows me to focus more on my taste, what I want to say, and less about whether I should say it. So I think what you're getting at with the seriousness and unseriousness is that, like, I definitely have the ability to, like, be talking about something that could be totally crude and, like, maybe even terrible to some people. Like, maybe some people would even be offended. But then I can also really talk about, like, you know, the beauty of life and the pain of heartbreak. And I think what is similar about these two things is the fact that I'm not scared. Like, I just don't worry that much about how I'm coming off. And that's risky, because you can bother people, you can hurt people. But what I've found in my life is that the more authentic you allow yourself to be, the more the world will just kind of, like, coincide with you to surround you with the kinds of people that you want, like, you should be surrounded by. Because everybody's gonna weed themselves out of your life, you know, because you're allowing them to reject you, right? Like, that rejection is necessary in order for you to be surrounded by the people you want to be surrounded by. And people live in fear of this rejection, but it's the rejection itself that's the cure, right? It's the rejection itself that puts you in the environment you want to be in. And so, like, people talk about vulnerability and fear of rejection and doing all of those things, and you can't just say, just be yourself. You can't just say, like, just be authentic. But I think over time, truly believing that it will work in your favor, you can kind of speak your own message, and it will be advantageous to you. Regarding the seriousness versus unserious, I definitely have my waves where I'll be either more serious or more unserious. I think right now I'm definitely more unserious, and I could be a lot more serious, and that would probably be good. It is really, you know, about threading the needle there. But it's also like, when I was in school, like middle school, I would tell jokes that nobody got just because I thought they were funny. And it's kind of like that. And then, like, once in a while, somebody would smile at me and they got the joke. And I would say it so deadpan that people didn't know what the hell I was talking about. And then somebody would just smile at me, like, and love the joke. And that was, like, way worth me pandering to anybody. And so that's kind of like, I will just have ideas, and I'll just tweet any idea. Like, I don't have to believe in it. I don't, like, right. it could just be in some kind of experiment. I don't really care. I'm just having fun. And so for me, Twitter is just about leaning into that. You know, it's just like, do whatever is fun relentlessly. And, you know, if you bother somebody, it's okay. You know, you don't want to hurt anybody. You don't want to make, you know, you don't want to create more negativity in the world than positivity. But you also have to kind of trust yourself, you know, just to do the right thing. And when you screw up, it's not the end of the world. Like, it's Twitter, you know.
Is fun your primary motivation between Twitter and the podcast? Or is there something grander you're trying to work towards, some other objective?
If there's anything grander, like, I guess in material form, I think that if I die without writing a book, that would be like a massive tragedy for me. Not necessarily anybody else. It would probably be a trash book, but it would be a tragedy for me because I do think that, like, for me, it's really about expressing this authenticity that I am talking about, and this, you know, speaking through a vulnerable lens that is not necessarily baked in fear. And I think I can do that. And I think that because I have that aptitude, let me get back. I'm going to back up and tell you a little bit about my history, which is that growing up, I was really, really good at math. All right. I was excellent at math. Like, I got a perfect 800 math SAT score, all that stuff. Like, I was really, really good at math, despite going to an absolutely terrible school. You know, that, like, I was 2 years behind on math. It was bad. So I just happened to be really, really excellent in math when I was a kid. And I didn't, you know, I had that capacity, but I didn't use it. I didn't really go to school for math. And that, if I have any regrets in life, like, that's definitely one of them, that, like, I had this, like, crazy 99th percentile plus aptitude, and I didn't really take advantage of that. And so I think that, like, my time for exercising my math muscles are probably, you know, gone. I'm in my 30s now. But I still do have this, there's something special about being able to be fearlessly authentic. And I think I do need to use that. And so if there is anything grander that I have to tap into, it's, you know, longer form writing. And the way I see this is, it's kind of like baby steps. Like, I do telling stories on Twitter, which is, you know, very condensed. It's a certain skill, but I do want to be able to thread this with more nuance, in a combination of, like, fiction and nonfiction in longer form, and eventually have a book of some kind, which is so cliche and probably narcissistic. But for me, it's something I definitely have to do and continue to work on.
Yeah, if that's where your authenticity is kind of pulling you, then I don't think there is a right or wrong answer, or that it comes across as narcissistic. Between your podcast and some of your threads, I think it's evident that you are a good storyteller, and I have confidence in your ability to write a book someday, if and when you choose. You also have excellent, you seem to have a good understanding of, like, film and television and the history of, and so you have this good kind of historical background, but then also personal experience with storytelling. And so I'm curious what your take is on kind of the 80-20 of good storytelling. What are those things that you have to get right that make a story worth watching, reading, listening to?
I'm gonna expand on this a little bit, which is that the irony is that I never actually thought of myself as a good storyteller. Like, I wasn't the guy at the, you know, Thanksgiving table, like, you know, spinning a yarn. I was never that guy. And really, in real life, most people have never praised me for this at all. And so I had, like, my eighth grade teacher thought I was amazing, but that was in the entire history of school, that was it. It was only my eighth grade teacher. So I didn't really think that I was an excellent, you know, I thought I was a fairly good writer, but I didn't really lean into the storytelling so much. Like, I did do a little bit of writing, but not a lot of storytelling. And then, you know, one night I'm drunk on Twitter and I write up this story about my life or whatever, and people freak out and people are like, oh, this is amazing. You know, I've got people that are, like, actual writers telling me I'm a great writer. And it kind of blew my mind that, like, here I am, like, 30 years old and, like, drunkenly discovering that I can tell stories. Extremely strange. So, you know, after that, I just leaned into it a little bit, started telling more stories. And this is all to say that, like, I'm a total amateur at this. Like, I probably just have some natural ability that is not properly expressed into anything, like, that is in any consumable form that is, I would say, really good. It's just like some tweets. But I seem to have a little bit of this talent. And what I would say for the 80-20 on storytelling, Ira Glass has this great rant that you can find about taste and about how when you're an amateur, you write or like perform in art poorly, and you can tell you're doing it poorly because you have good taste. And that it really takes a lot of work for your like your output to match your taste, for your skill to kind of match what you want it to be in your mind. And so I think the 80-20 for me in storytelling is you have to have the taste. If you don't have the taste, don't even try, I would say. Like, define what you have taste in. If you have taste in fashion, if you have taste in cooking, do that. Because you can't easily, you know, pull storytelling taste out of nowhere, because we're already in the social fabric. And if you don't have it by now, if you haven't been paying attention by now to have the taste between a good and a bad story, then it's kind of hopeless. So, but outside of that, it's really like a sensitivity. So this was one of the reasons that I thought I would be a decent podcaster, is that like I'm constantly aware of the audience. Like, they're real for me. I'm, you know, not necessarily speaking to them. I feel like I'm speaking to you, but I'm kind of aware that I need to keep this moving. I need to keep this interesting, and I need to be sharing something that somebody wants to hear. And that has to be like burning in the back of your mind all the time. You know, you can be writing for yourself. You can be writing in your journal or something. But if you want to be a good storyteller, a story told is only half the storyteller, and the other half is the person listening. And if you're like, you have to be talking to that person. And so you have to be able to exercise your taste over what is and is not interesting. And so it's just having this sensitivity to kind of like what is and isn't interesting, but pretty much along every dimension. Like, it's not just like make it exciting, right? Not everything is an action movie. But, you know, even in your slow moments, it has to serve the experience itself. And, you know, that's kind of nebulous. Is there anything else worth telling about? I have a really terrible memory. So I think this might help, because I don't remember 1,000 details about every story. I really only remember the things that were very emotionally salient to me. And so, you know, I can exercise some imagination and try to explore the space and see if there's really anything I want to pick out of an environment. But I pretty much just tell a story the way it occurs to me and like the emotional salience of my mind. And, you know, that's kind of it. So maybe having a really poor memory helps.
You may have left out arguably the most important part of telling a good story, which is having an actually good story to tell. Doesn't matter how good of a storyteller you are if it's a shit story. And I was continually surprised. I mean, I've been following you for a couple of years now, but I went back through kind of your Twitter archives to dig up some old material, and was continually surprised by the number and variety of fascinating stories. And I was trying to figure out if that was a function of luck or some way you've like engineered your life. But it struck me that you're like in the upper percentile in terms of fascinating lives. And so I was curious what you would attribute that to. Was it just like luck and circumstance, or is it something about how you are, the way you live?
Firstly, thank you. You know, I don't know how to take that compliment, because I'm, you know, it's I work at Costco, and you know, I've got like a regular life for sure. And a lot of the people that I meet on the timeline definitely to me seem more interesting than myself. But I am grateful of that kind compliment. But if there is anything that has made life more interesting for me, it's that I kind of like things to not be mediocre. So I lean into things, whether they're good or bad, just if they're going to become a good story, that's enough of a risk, like to take the risk rather. So I just don't want things to be like forgettably boring. And so just in my life, you know, if I have two options, I'm probably going to take the more interesting option and not just live completely conservatively, just because in the way I remember my life, like my life has been marked by things that are interesting. And even the bad experiences, if they were sufficiently interesting, that's like good enough for like them to be a worthwhile experience. And so I think just throughout my life, you know, I could have made some choices that would have just, you know, resulted in these stories not happening. But instead I just want to entertain myself. I want to be interesting. I want to live an interesting life. I want to have interesting experiences. And I think that's, you know, there's that OkCupid question, which is like, would you rather like live in interesting times or not? I forget the specific question. But it's definitely like, you know, interestingness can be a double-bladed sword or whatever the hell it's called. But it's, for me, it's, you know, another cliche. It's just the spice of life. Like, it just makes things better.
One of the flavors of stories that you most frequently tell is around relationships. And it sounds like you've had a few of them for better or for worse. And I juxtapose that to my life, where I've been with my now wife for like 13 years or something. And don't have very much experience.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And don't have very much experience with dating. I've developed, of course, my own opinions about like what makes a relationship function. But I'm curious, given how different your background has been to mine, if there's any, and maybe especially non-consensus or like non-conforming realizations or insights you have about what makes a relationship makes or breaks them.
All right. So I'm going to lean into Breaks one.
Okay.
Blunderbusted, who goes by Beast on Twitter, just tweeted a moment ago, like, I love logging on every day to read unrelenting advice on dating and love from people who have found neither in their 18 to 80 years on this planet. And I definitely have found love, but, you know, my longest relationships were kind of like on and off for 2.5 years or something like that. Or, I would definitely take more love advice from you than me, but I definitely have a lot of experience with heartbreak. So I can talk a lot about that. So I could tell you what's wrong, or what goes wrong often. And, I think the number one thing is like, you have to have the right materials to start. Like the hope to make a relationship good is never going to make a relationship good enough. It has to be a good relationship, like just par, like the baseline default. You kind of have to like each other. It's not that, like, you have to like each other after you know each other, right? Not in the beginning when you're like, oh my God, I have a girlfriend. No, you have to like each other when you know each other. And if you don't have that, that's going to, it's hopeless. And once you have that, I think what is going to break up a relationship is just not having good communication and good communication practices, and just the capacity to understand and communicate, because that is like the program that's going to get you through like the really, really hard stuff, is kind of being able to not only feel heard, but like being able to do the work. And you can't do any of the work if you can't communicate. So, you know, I don't know if that's fortunate. I think having both of those things is already like mega rare. And so I would say the third thing is just like, don't screw it up. Like, you know, a lot of my relationships have ended because they went to France or they went to Alaska and things were good. And, you know, and we might've had a bunch of dimensions of things being great, but then like we didn't stick together. And so like, you know, not leaning into any failure modes where things are just going to blow up, you know, I would say, look hard. You can't settle for someone you don't genuinely like. Like, you really, really have to like spending time with them. Or that's going to make things fall apart. If you lack any amount of communication, You know, you can probably work through it, but it's going to be really emotionally expensive and challenging and miserable, mm-hmm. probably. And then, you know, make sacrifices, because if you're not sacrificing most of everything else for the success of that relationship, then you're going to end up leaning into a failure mode where things just blow up. And, you know, that last part, it's kind of strange, because I don't think you want to sacrifice your happiness. Like, I think you do have to spend time with friends. You have to do your hobbies. You have to respect yourself, and you don't want to give everything away, but you also, you know, I think that one of the things that led to a lot of the failures in my relationships is just that, like, I wanted too many things. And if you want too many things, then you're probably going to start making decisions that are just, like, not on track for that relationship to be a forever relationship, you know? And also thinking that, oh, I can just find another relationship this great is wrong, because any other relationship, even if it might, even if the man or the woman is just as great, the fact is that you lost all that time you spent together, that year and a half, 2 years or whatever, you know, unless you get back together at some point in the future or something, which is extremely unlikely, all that time is gone. And that's not nothing. It's not nothing. So I would say, when you're in something really, really good, like, be smart about it, you know, don't be an ass.
I think this view of optionality or replaceability, and again, yeah. coming from the perspective of someone who's not in the dating world, seems to be at the heart of, or at least one of the key reasons why people struggle with relationships nowadays. I mean, you go on, there's this thought that you can go on Tinder and find the next thing in 30 minutes, or go on right. the internet and meet somebody else, which I think, to your point, is just not actually the case. There's a lot more tied up in finding a person and in developing that relationship. It might feel like, you know, for the first month or 3 months of the relationship, it's replaceable. You're in that honeymoon phase. But to have longevity, there's got to be more of a sense of commitment and appreciation for the uniqueness of that relationship. I suppose that's my two cents on that topic. There's one other thread I wanted to pull on around relationships. And this is me kind of inferring or reading between the lines of a lot of the comments you've had on relationships, on Twitter. It seems like you've experienced a fair amount of heartbreak. And I think for anyone, you mentioned earlier how, in fact, like, you were in this meditative present state, and it was, in fact, breaking up with somebody that led to those walls, those defense mechanisms coming right back. Right. How do you prevent against that? How do you stay kind of vulnerable and open to relationships, understanding that that's the only way they can actually work is by being, to your earlier point, authentic?
I think you have to appreciate why those defense mechanisms exist. Like, you have to see their true value, because if you think they're strictly bad, then you're going to get yourself into a fight with yourself that doesn't really have any end. But, you know, like, so I really enjoyed the state of presence, for instance, and it ended when, like, basically my greatest fear, you know, came up, which right. was like that, you know, this thing that for me is such a sensitive point. And I hate focusing on myself in this situation, because she went through something terrible. Like, I do want to, like, it's very uncomfortable for me to talk about me in this situation, because she was the one that experienced the trauma.
Sure.
It absolutely terrible. To your question, like, how do you remain vulnerable and authentic in a relationship where that's necessary, right? So I would just say, like, recognize how both of these things are necessary, and in understanding why you seek to protect yourself and, you know, like, take care of yourself, keep that in the front of your mind, but don't make that a fight with your partner, right? because like if you make if your defensiveness, right, is against your partner rather than this kind of like defensiveness over experience itself or your own insecurities, your own weaknesses, right? Like we're going to have those internal battles. But by recognizing that, like we are doing our best for ourselves, while also recognizing that there's this other human being that I need to relate to, even when it's hard, and I need to relate to them, you know, even when I kind of don't want to, maybe, and that I, even when I don't feel like going out, maybe I need to go out. And it's not because, you know, my feelings are unimportant, but it's because, you know, maintaining a good relationship is one of the most important things. And that means that you have to sacrifice a little bit of what you want for what you need in the long term. And it's just like, so how do we get back to being authentic? It does take a little bit of courage because there's probably some fear, right? Mm-hmm. There's probably some fear going on. And so we recognize what that fear is. What's the fear that I'm facing right now? Try to look at it realistically, maybe not like rationalistically, but just practically, and be kind to yourself, be kind to the other person, and try to invite as much honesty as you can into that communication.
I like the framing of distinguishing between, it's not that those emotions or fears you're having aren't real or important, but you might be misplacing them or projecting them on that relationship rather than understanding that's something you're feeling as a result of your past experience, and trying to differentiate between those two things. So that they don't get kind of conflated, and then it ends up impacting the relationship negatively.
Right.
It's really insightful. We've gone well over the time. There's one question I always like to ask in closing, the same question for everyone, which is, what's one question you'd leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
Well, I'll think about the listeners, like a general question. But while I'm thinking of that, I want to ask you, what are some technical things, I guess behind the scenes, that have helped you become a better podcaster? You know, just like something that maybe people wouldn't get just by listening to your show.
Great question. I didn't come on here expecting to be interviewed at my own podcast. I'll say a couple things. One that immediately comes to mind that you already touched on, and this is a topic that's come up repeatedly on the podcast, especially recently, is just the idea of like cultivating taste, and that's done through each person has their own kind of innate starting level or understanding of taste, but ultimately the only way you kind of graduate and get better is through repetition and exposure. And so like to that effect, nothing replaces the work. Like you just gotta go do it repeatedly until you you know, you find out, oh, I like this, oh, this didn't feel good, I'm not gonna do this again. I felt that, like, just frankly during the course of this conversation, I felt like, oh, the way I phrased that question didn't feel right. There's tension. He's pausing. He's got to, you know, kind of find the right way to navigate this versus, oh, that was a well-executed question. I put up proper kind of like barriers or guardrails, gives him space to operate within, but isn't so constraining that like it's an obvious answer. But there just starts to develop this like felt sense of what is good and bad. So that's the first thing I would say. And then kind of technical behind the scenes. I mean, the other thing, maybe these are one and the same. It's just like, similarly, nothing replaces doing the research and like understanding the person you're talking to and the topic you're talking about. And I think that shines through. Like when I felt like I've done really thorough research and understand this person, not just the things they're talking about, but like can make kind of inferences about their psychology and where they're coming from and why they think the way they do, then the the conversation becomes much more natural. And I think I have to refer less to the like script or the questions I've come up with. And there's just like natural segues. Those are the two that come to mind. There might be stuff that's like imperceptible for me at this point also, because I've just been doing it for a while now, because this is like, I think this is my 30th episode for this podcast, but I also did 20 episodes on my previous one. So there might be ways in which I just don't even realize I'm doing something that other folks don't do because I haven't had exposure to their process.
Yeah. For me, briefly answering the question for me is like I edit my show and I spend a lot of time editing my show, and that gives me like a feedback loop, because if I screw up on the show, sometimes I'll cut out like some of my voice and re-record it if it's sufficiently bad. And I'm creating more work for myself when I'm not doing a good job on the show.
I like that.
And so that really motivates my doing better on the show. And so it kind of creates this, I guess, flywheel effect of becoming better. So that for me was like the number one, I guess, behind the scenes thing that you know, it's hard, but, I probably do too much editing, but it definitely motivates, a lot of my show. But on the downside, because it takes so much time for me to do that, it makes it so that like, it's a little bit of a mountain to climb for me to put out an episode, which you don't really want. Like you want more, like you said, you just want to do the work. But you know, when you're working and you got all this stuff going on, it's so easy to make excuses and like not do as much productivity as you want to. So these are all just aspects.
What have you found to be your biggest kind of repeated challenges or struggles with the medium? Like those things I imagine there's aspects of this that come really naturally to you, and there's other ones you got to work on and refine. What are the latter?
The trickiest thing for me, and I've been thinking about this a lot, but just some of the logistics of like setting up episodes, it feels so clumsy. It's always so clumsy. Yeah. I'm like, there's got to be a better way. And there's that. And it's also how to design the episode, because you really want the episode to fit the person. And so some of my episodes, like I could tell about like my Michael Kersey episode was extremely conversational. It was like just back and forth almost the entire time. And I think I only looked at my notes like 3 times. Whereas with other people, I'll ask them a question and they'll give me like a 1-minute response, and then I'm out of questions, you know, in half an hour or something. And I'm trying to think of questions. And it's just like, you kind of got to know who you're talking to, which can be hard if you have, you know, have never been on the phone with them. And I try to solve this by getting on the phone with people, you know, seeing if we have banter, you know, and outside of that, just like you said, doing the research. Yeah. So the question that I would end this with, for everybody, and I say this because it's one of the hardest questions for me to answer and to really look at in my own life, is basically like, what am I avoiding and why? Because by the inherent nature of us avoiding things, it's like we're creating our own blind spots. And when you really start to ask that question, like, I don't know about you, but I feel resistance just like saying that question out loud, that I don't want to do it. But I think it's what's important. Like, you got to look at that.
What is the, probably a few quotes about this, but I don't know if it's Jung or someone else who has a quote to this effect of like, the answers are found where you least want to look.
Right. Yeah.
That is 100% true. That's a great call to action. Awesome. Well, Nick, thank you so much for your time. Hopefully you aren't regretting not getting on the call with me before we did this to find out that I wasn't that good of an interviewer. But this was a lot of fun.
I had a great time.